This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the March Madness edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. Mark and I are taking a little break from our regular gigs and are at the Big Ten's men's basketball tournament in Chicago, but still tracking the madness that is Tucker Carlson and Fox News, along with the incredibly productive new legislative majority in Lansing.
And I'm Mark Brewer. The new Democratic majority in the legislature is moving major legislation at a record-setting pace. Several large bills have cleared the legislature just in the last 7 days, among them a nearly $1 billion tax cut, mandatory background checks for all gun purchases, an expansion of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, providing basic protections for the LGBTQ community, and a $630 million incentive package for the Ford battery plant in Marshall. Other bills moving quickly through the legislature repeal the Snyder-era attacks on unions, repeal Michigan's 1931 abortion law, which was a ban on abortion, a criminal ban on abortion, and enact new gun safety laws.
Later in the podcast, we'll talk to my one-time partner at the Michigan Republican Party headquarters, Saul Anuzis, and we'll talk to Saul about a national bipartisan drive to make sure the second-place finisher in presidential voting doesn't end up in the White House anyway. But Mark, let's begin with a little more analysis and discussion about all the activity in Lansing. You know, we've talked before since the election last November about 40 years of pent-up Democratic ideas. Now there's a whole lot of things taking place simultaneously. I get the sense from a lot of the Lansing watchers, the reporters, that they're kind of surprised at the flurry of in the swiftness of all this action. But the fact that the walking and chewing gum are happening at the same time doesn't seem that surprising. But tell me your reaction to what the Democrats are passing, and are they doing it the right way?
Yeah, I think everything that's going on is predictable based on, the campaign promises made by the governor and the Democrats who ran for the legislature. Many of these bills, as you know, Jeff, have been sitting there for years. They were bills that Democrats have introduced, to enhance the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not hard to move that. They do seem to be very determined, very organized in terms of getting bills to the floor. But I got to say, and I don't think I'm saying anything anybody doesn't realize already, that with some of these bills, this is just the first step or the latest step in a longer fight. We've already seen on the gun legislation front groups threatening recalls. Recalls are very difficult under Michigan law, but people can still try and still make that threat. And then there's the whole arena that I've spent so much time in the last 20 years, which is ballot proposals. That people can use ballot proposals as a referendum to block some of this, attempt to at least, to pass superseding initiatives, or, as progressives have done the last several years, starting with what we saw in 218 with voters not politicians, but also the voting rights proposals, pass constitutional amendments, right? Put things in the Constitution, and that obviously trumps legislation. So I think, again, great achievements. I'm obviously very proud of my party in terms of what they're doing. There's a lot more to come. But I also think the opposition is not just going to roll over either. The alternatives I just talked about are expensive, right? Recalls aren't cheap. Ballot proposals aren't cheap. They're hard to mount. But there are a lot of resources on the other side. The DeVosses aren't going away. The National Right to Work folks aren't going away. Michigan is a real battleground on the right to work piece. So I suspect there will be move, counter move here as we go forward. Once these bills get signed and become law, that'll be the next fight. And that fight may not even be over this election cycle.
That hasn't been talked about enough, the angle of referenda, of superseding initiatives or constitutional amendments. The Republicans now trying to do with the ballot box in November, what they're unable to do in the legislature, an arena that they've dominated for so long. They have to rethink their strategy and tactics. But it seems like the Republican donors or Republican interest groups might have a little more cash laying around, since it doesn't seem to be going to the Michigan Republican Party. So it might be able to go into efforts like that. And so that'll be curious to watch. Certainly the gun safety measures going through Lansing, interesting poll out in the Detroit News, Detroit Chamber sponsored poll this week, showing, you know, overwhelming 90% support for many of these gun measures. But the reporting of it still shows how that this is a closely divided partisan issue. And the groups that oppose it are small in number in terms of voters, but large in numbers in terms of influence in the legislature and availability of cash.
Yeah, it's certainly there in terms of all these things. And look, you know, the things that I were just talking about aren't new. I mean, when I became chair of the Democratic Party and we faced a Republican majority under John Engler's leadership, we started to go to the ballot. You know, we did ballot proposals right in my first term of as chair, and it's just increased. And that is the way the system works, that groups that don't feel they've got the ability to influence the executive or legislative agenda have, under Michigan law, and this is true in about half the states, the option of going to the ballot. Now, it's got its rigors. It's got its obstacles. It's not as easy, obviously, as working something through the legislature if you've got a majority, but that option is there. And progressives and Democrats have taken great advantage of that over the last several years, particularly. But it's equally available in our democracy. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether groups take advantage of it and how this all plays out.
Yeah, you're right. And they've taken on such a partisan flavor, these ballot initiatives or various attempts over time. But this is democracy in action. This is how Michigan's constitution was constructed back in 1963 to make Michigan an initiative and referenda state that gave direct democracy on these issues to the citizens or citizens who are able to organize, get themselves onto the ballot through petitioning and then run effective persuasion campaigns to get people behind them. And so that it's not a bad thing. So listeners hear me talk about the, you know, the Republicans trying to game the system when they weren't able to do it in the legislature. Well, yes, they were voted out and the system allows them to do this. We can come down to motive and talk about that with each initiative that pops up, because I think some attempts at this are more democratic with a small d than others. Certainly the Republicans gaming the initiative system when they had majorities in the legislature to bypass the governor was I think an unintended consequence of the folks at the Constitutional Convention back in the early 1960s.
Yeah, we'll see how it all plays out. Look, I think the rules should be equal for both sides. For my party, for progressives, you know, we're going to make sure if these ballot proposals come forward that they follow the rules. You know, the form is correct. You got enough signatures. And if you follow the rules, you get to go on the ballot. And then we have a debate and the voters ultimately decide in a rare form of direct democracy that we have. But Jeff, I want to, if I can, turn it back to you, though. You know, a lot in the news lately about, you know, it's all coming out about how much behind the scenes, people like Tucker Carlson and all these other Fox personalities were trashing Trump and his strategy back in 2020, even at the same time they were parading all these election deniers on their show every night. This has all come out now as a result of this defamation suit that was filed against Fox. What's your take on what was going on there? I mean, it's really cynical stuff. Is that going to have any impact on Fox viewers? Is it going to have any impact on the politics as we get into 2024?
Well, I don't think it's going to have any impact on the Fox viewers because they're not going to see it. I mean, the information they get is filtered through whatever Fox wants them to get. And so Fox is not exactly covering these revelations about the internal machinations, the internal attitudes. You know, Tucker Carlson saying, you know, I hate and loathe Donald Trump. I mean, this is after in November of 2020, where, you know, then the night before and then after the night after, you know, he's on, you know, giving Trump what amounts to a sponge bath, you know, on his show. And it underscores what we've known and what people have talked about for now seven, almost 8 years, is that Republicans, the governing class of Republicans, and I would include the kind of weaponized media PR wing of the Republican Party, which is Fox News and some of the right wing folks, think that Donald Trump is an idiot. They have no respect for him. They only fear him. They think he's a rube. They think he's a fool. They think he's impulsive. They think he's in many times dangerous. But they also recognize they want to make money and they want to win elections. So they go along in public with Donald Trump. But this is the kind of shit that people have said behind the scenes for a long time, and they'll continue to. And Donald Trump will continue to thrive on their cowardice because they're coward, and that's really what it is. Either their greed and cowardice have created this monster and unleashed this cancer within our politics and culture that has subsumed the right of our politics and subsumed the Republican Party to the point where it's really no longer a party, but a mechanism for this authoritarian nationalist movement to gain power. And they've co-opted and taken over the Republican Party. This cancer has metastasized, and that's how it manifests itself. And these people, they enabled it to happen. And that's why, I've never called myself just anti-Trump. I'm anti-Trump and anti-Trump enablers. And, I've got this hellfire and vengeance Old Testament attitude toward these people. And I'm glad to see them getting their just rewards, because it seems like the Dominion lawyers are just going to make this very painful for Fox and just keep drip, drip, drip this stuff out there. And the effect it's going to have, it's not going to have any effect on the Fox viewers and most of the right-wing viewers, but it's going to have, I think, a continued galvanizing effect on the majority of Americans who don't get their news from Fox, who do support, whether they've been historic Republicans or independent center right voters, have voted for Joe Biden, voted for Democratic candidates like Gretchen Whitmer or Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania or Tony Evers in Wisconsin. It's going to galvanize them against this crazy, manipulative, far right, radicalized, dangerous movement that's kind of disguised as the Republican Party.
Yeah, we've come a long way from journalists who used to think about the impact on the country and on democracy of what they said. These Fox revelations, folks knew what they were saying was wrong, and they didn't care about the impact on the country. All they were interested in was ratings. We can't afford to offend our viewers by telling them the truth of what Trump is saying and what these election deniers are all about. We got to continue to feed them these falsehoods, or else they won't watch our program. That's how far Fox has descended, and that's a very sad commentary.
Next up, a leader in the national effort to make sure the presidential candidate with the most votes wins on a republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better. We have the Ben Franklin hoodie, dedicated to Americans for sanity. But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
Joining the podcast today, someone I had the challenge of battling when I was chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, is former Republican Chair Saul Anousis. Saul was chairman of the Michigan Republican Party from 2005 to 2009. He was also a candidate for national chairman of the Republican National Committee in 2009 and 2011.
Saul's political career started early. At the University of Michigan Dearborn, Saul was the first chairman of the College Republican Club. In 1980, 21-year-old Saul Anousis was elected as the youngest delegate to the Republican National Convention in Detroit that year. A year later, he was elected third vice chairman, the youth vice chairman of the Republican Party in Michigan in 1981.
Today, Saul is one of the leaders in a bipartisan effort to reform the presidential election process. The United States is the only democracy in the world that makes it possible to finish second in an election and still win. Two of our last four presidents lost the popular vote, but were elected thanks to the Electoral College. The National Popular Vote Initiative, which Saul helps lead, would end that giant-sized quirk in our elections and ensure that the person who gets the most votes nationally becomes president. It's a pleasure to welcome my longtime friend, Saul Anousis, to the podcast. You and I are off on a bipartisan project supporting the national popular vote. Let's talk about that and tell us what it is and what you've been doing and what's going on in Michigan with the national popular vote.
Well, as you well know, and hopefully your listeners have heard from you before about this, but basically the national popular vote, very straightforward, is a process to make sure that every voter in every state is politically relevant every time, and that every state in the country is a battleground state every time. As you remember back in 2008, when you and I were both there, Michigan was a battleground state on one day. And a weekend later, McCain campaign came out with a poll that showed them 12 points down. And the next day, we were a battleground state. And it was pretty devastating effect for us on the Republican side because, you know, we had just transferred a little over $7 million to the federal account for the Get Out the Vote effort, as is required by law. And, we thought that, everything was going well. And we get this phone call and saying, hey, even though you're a battleground state, and by the way, your money was all sent to Florida and Ohio. And, from my perspective, I don't know why a voter in Florida or Ohio should be more relevant than a voter in Michigan. So, look, we elect 514,000 elected officials in this country, all of whom who are elected by whoever gets the most votes but one, the one that represents the country as a whole. And I think that creates a whole lot of problems because for all practical purposes, we elect the president of the battleground states of America versus the president of the United States of America. And I think that perverts public policy and it perverts politics. I'm more than comfortable to take my case, in our case, the Republicans, the people of this country and across the state of Michigan and, taking a look at the political environment, if things are going well, we're going to win. If we've got good candidates with good messages, we win. And when we don't, we lose. This is a closely divided country. It's probably a third Republican, a third Democrat, and a third independent. People move based on the mood of the country and what's going on at the time. And, the nice part about this process is it's something that you and I can agree with because primarily it's fundamentally fair, right? I mean, let the best man or woman win, let the race go out there and make your case. And, I think as long as it's fair and both sides have an even shot at it, it's hard to object. And if your only purpose is to win, that's not necessarily, the right thing or the way to do this. I mean, I'm more concerned about making sure that every voter in every state is politically relevant every time. And that's really the bottom line from my perspective.
I think that's right. So, in our party, the Democratic Party, we get complaints from rural Democrats all the time. Right. You all ignore us. You just focus on the urban areas and now the suburbs. And we've been talking a lot about this national popular vote recently with them. And I said, hey, look, this means that these candidates are going to have to campaign for every vote everywhere. That means rural areas in Michigan as well as rural areas around the country. So I think you're right, Saul. It really does mean that every voter will be equally important. Right. The way the Electoral College works now, Michigan voters are actually devalued. Right. Our vote is worth less than the votes of voters in, say, Wyoming. So it is a kind of a violation of one person, one vote, the way the Electoral College currently operates. This would straighten that out.
Yeah, it's the winner-take-all rule. It's not the Electoral College that's a problem, because remember, the purpose of the Electoral College is really to give the states the ability to run and administer elections. So we're not changing the Electoral College. In fact, I would argue we are not only preserving, but we're strengthening the Electoral College, because we're making sure that voters in all 50 states matter, and we're making sure that every voter in Michigan matters. You know, Michigan, look, 48 out of the 50 states use what's called a winner-take-all rule, and two of them use a congressional district plan. And under the winner-take-all rule, if the Democrats win Michigan by one vote, 100% of our delegates go to Michigan, and the Republican votes become irrelevant in the overall process. And the same is true and the vice versa. If the Republicans win by one vote and they get 100% of the electors to the Electoral College, and every Democratic vote is ignored by 100%, under a national popular vote, every one of our votes will be added to the national total. We will be part of deciding who the president of the United States is. And this is one of the reasons that I think it's important. Look, from a Michigan perspective, I mean, we care about the auto industry. We care about manufacturing. We care about the Great Lakes. I mean, we are a unique state, and we want both Republicans and Democrats to pay attention to the issues that affect this country. You know, you and I oftentimes used to debate and talk about the fact that we come at this from different perspectives. You know, both of us were very partisan, but we both wanted what was good for Michigan and what was good for the country. We just had a different perspective of how to get there. And the point was, we were able to talk. We were able to agree to disagree, and we were able to have that debate. Today, we're down to three or four battleground states in any given year, with maybe 10 to 12 potential battleground states overall. And, you know, people are pandering, Republicans and Democrats, to the battleground state voters. And there's hundreds of examples across the country on how that's happened. And I think that's bad for the body politic. It's not what the process was, you know, designed to do.
People hear about this, and it's been in the news a lot in the last, you know, month or so in Michigan. But let's get into the weeds a little bit and talk about how, okay, the Michigan legislature, say they vote for this and it's signed by the governor. What then? How does this work nationally?
Yep. So basically, it's an agreement between the states that when enough states that have 270 electoral votes or more join the compact, it kicks in by July of an election year. And so then when, let's assume, I mean, realistically, it probably won't happen for 2024, but there's a good chance, there's at least a 50-50 chance it happens by 2028. So let's say Michigan and four or five or six other states join that make up 270 electoral votes or more, which is the magic number it takes to win a presidential election. Then they agree to vote as a block for the candidate who wins the majority of votes in all 50 states plus the District of Columbia. So it doesn't matter whether you're in or out of the compact, all 50 states are participating. It's just that that group of states sends their electors to the Electoral College as a block. So today, 15 states plus the District of Columbia have passed this interstate compact. Nothing has changed. Those states happen to have 195 electoral votes, which means we're 75 electoral votes away from having the compact kick in. And the beauty of the compact is you kind of get into it the same way you get out of it. Let's say there's unintended consequences, or people aren't happy with the way it worked, or, you know, it's just not working out. States can pull out of that compact and we revert back to the current system. So it's kind of a check and balance on the process to say, you know, does it make sense to have a 50 state strategy? Does it make sense to have Republicans and Democrats campaigning across the country every time? And again, it doesn't mean that a Republican or Democratic candidate is necessarily going to go to every single state the same amount of times, et cetera. I mean, obviously, we're going to have a strategy. I mean, the best way to look at this is a presidential campaign would be run very similar to how a competitive gubernatorial campaign is run in Michigan, or a U.S. Senate campaign is run in Michigan. Republicans will campaign to maximize their votes in outstate Michigan, do their best to minimize their losses in urban areas, you know, fight the fight in suburban areas, and the Democrats will do vice versa. And nobody can afford to ignore a single voter. Whether you're in Detroit or Ishpeming, whether you're in Kalamazoo or Alpena, Republicans and Democrats, when every vote counts, goes after every voter across the state.
Yeah, since 2020, we've seen, you know, so much of the finagling and maneuvering takes place after Election Day, or the potential for it. Could this potentially increase the opportunity for chaos after the election, with legislatures then becoming effectively up for sale to the candidate who would win or lose by them either staying in the compact or pulling out after the vote? How would that work and affect, you know, would this just add a layer of litigation and confusion?
No, I actually think we would do the opposite, because what would basically, first of all, in the compact, there's a provision in the compact that basically says you can't get in or out of the compact until July 20th of the election year and after the inaugural on presidential year. So in effect, you can't game the system by law. You've agreed to that in a compact, and compacts are kind of considered, I'm not a lawyer, but they're like kind of super uber agreements between the states. I mean, it's the Great Lakes compact or the, you know, the lottery compact. So, I mean, if you win the lottery in Michigan, Ohio can't say, well, we're not going to pay our fair share. It just doesn't work that way. So A, it doesn't allow for gaming the system. B, the fact that we have a national popular vote winner, I think brings a lot of calmness to the process. Everybody's watching on television and they see somebody won the national popular vote. And by definition, they're not only going to win the Electoral College, they're going to win it by much larger margins than traditionally are won. Because let's say there's 30 states that enter the compact that have 270 electoral votes and they vote one way or the other. The other 20 states plus the District of Columbia would be basically split, and Democratic states would send their electors to the Democratic side, Republican electors would send it to the Republican side, and we're more likely to have like 300 plus votes in the Electoral College going for the candidate. So I think you would have kind of this consensus amongst the general public and amongst the media and all the talking heads that clearly this is the winner of the presidential elections. And I think that would calm a lot of the, you know, the processes down. I mean, look, we still have to deal with the question of voter fraud and voter integrity and all the issues that people are concerned about. But those are state issues. Those are issues that are handled at, you know, every local level, et cetera. You know, we're seeing election reforms on multiple levels being passed and discussed. Some things being thrown out is just not being real. Other things are addressing issues to kind of calm the general public. And it's important that people are comfortable with how the system works and how the process works. Because, you know, we put a lot of faith in our government. We put a lot of faith in, you know, the politicians that lead this. I mean, as a constitutional republic, as a democratic republic that elects representatives to represent us, it's important that we're comfortable with how they got there and why they're there, et cetera. So I think this actually is a calming factor. I think it will make people feel more confident that the election went the way it was supposed to go. And I think it will actually have a positive effect moving forward, so we don't have the kinds of situations we had on January 6th, or the election deniers for years and, you know, years after the election, you know, losing by hundreds of thousands of votes and still saying I should be X.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So I think, as you indicated earlier, this will align the Electoral College result with the popular vote. And too often now, we had a couple of recent examples of this where they were out of whack, right? Somebody got a majority of the vote, but somebody else won the Electoral College. This will prevent that from happening. On election night, we'll be watching one number. Who's got the most votes in the entire country? That's that right. Person becomes president. And like you said, I think, you know, the kind of things we saw in Florida, you know, the infamous hanging chads, I think that really does minimize the impact of all that. You know, the entire country's election doesn't turn on a few hundred votes in one state, because we had a national popular vote winner back in 2000, right? And so I think those kinds of disputes, they'll still be there and they'll still be important to resolve, but the entire national election won't turn on them because of the way the Electoral College currently functions.
That's right. And I think that the other thing is that, you know, people, especially on my side of the aisle, will say, hey, you know, the founders had it right, or, you know, this is circumventing the Constitution. Let's remember, the founders basically debated, you know, 31 proposals over 21 days and could not agree how to elect the president of the United States. And ironically, or interestingly enough, the one that came the closest was actually a national popular vote that won by one vote at the constitutional in the Continental Congress. And so, you know, they couldn't agree. And so they basically said, let's use the great, you know, the grand compromise that was basically done for the Senate and the House to make sure that every state has two senators, every, you know, state is reflected by the population with regards to how the state is made up. And we create this electoral college based on the College of Cardinals on how a pope was elected, but they left it up to the states to decide how they were to do that. And so early on, you know, governors used to appoint electors, legislature used to appoint electors, the legislature used to elect electors from their citizenry as well as from their membership. We had situations where electors actually ran for office to be electors for one candidate or the other, and kind of moving in and out of the Civil War. Both the North and the South wanted reliable electors as they were kind of negotiating how the country was going to be made up moving out of the Civil War. They moved to what was referred to back then as the winner-take-all rule, and they kind of left it there. And very few states have gone back and forth after the Civil War, Massachusetts being the one unique one that literally 12 times has gone back and forth and tried congressional district plans, apportionment plans, et cetera. And they've jumped back and forth because part of what the founders wanted and intended was that states were going to act in their selfish best interest when determining how their electors were chosen so that they would be represented. And when 4 out of 5 Americans live in states that are decidedly Republican or decidedly Democrat, they're completely ignored. I mean, to me, it makes zero sense why a safe Republican state or a safe Democratic state would want to support a system that basically made their vote irrelevant. And it's not that your vote doesn't count at all, but when politicians are not coming to your state, when they're not talking to your political leaders, when they're not engaging the constituencies in your state, you lose power, you lose influence. You're not affecting the debate in the presidential process. And, you know, the presidency has now grown to be so much more powerful than the founders ever intended, than the founders ever thought would happen. The idea that somehow we come up with a rationale that says, well, the founders wanted it to be this way. They, first of all, they did not want it to be this way. They, in fact, if you go back and you read, you know, like Federalist 68 and others, they explicitly tried to figure out ways to spread this election out so that more and more people would involve, that everybody's voice would be heard. And I think, again, this is where we move to a system where we do the same thing, where we elect every other candidate in the country, from dog catcher to congressman, from state representative to governor. We elect them by whoever gets the most votes, and we make sure that every voter matters.
Yeah, this makes, you know, on the fairness scale, this makes a lot of sense. There are more Republican voters in California than in any other state.
Yeah.
And there are more,
more than 27 states combined.
Yeah. And there are more Democrat votes in Texas than in any other state but California or maybe New York in any given election year. But you're right. They're largely ignored by the presidential campaigns on either side, or, you know, even in small states, you know, the Democratic candidate running for president would have incentive to campaign through the Mississippi Delta, you know, in Mississippi, Louisiana, and in the old Cotton South, trying to gin up turnout, trying to goose, a few votes out of those states that they don't do right now. And conversely, Republican candidates would have incentive to go into New York State, into New England, into places like Maryland or California or Washington State or Oregon, where now there's none that exists and for them to go there. So yeah, this is an idea whose time is right. I know you've been working on it for a long time, but the forces seem to be aligning for something like this now.
And I think it's important for people to realize this is not a partisan issue. We're not doing this because we think it's better for Republicans or better for Democrats or one side or the other is going to win. I mean, the strength of the proposal is it's quintessentially fair. It allows both candidates, both parties to have the same process in place and play the game kind of in the same way, rather than trying to thread the needle on figuring out which state is going to be a battleground state and how can I pander to those unique voters in that state and make all our friends who are in micro targeting more money than they make right now in this process. And I think that the beauty of this is that, look, I believe we're a center-right nation. I'm more than comfortable taking our case to the American people. And I think with the right candidate, the right message, we can win. And most of the Democrats that I work with on this issue kind of believe the same thing. They think it's a center-left nation. They're comfortable taking their case to the American people and making sure their candidates are out there. So to me, that's like the perfect scenario because we have both sides making their case. You know, sometimes one side gets lucky, the other side doesn't. I mean, you pick a better candidate, a worse candidate. You know, there's always going to be the political, you know, machinations that take place in a normal campaign, mistakes, et cetera. But, you know, at least every voter in every state is going to be relevant here. And we're going to force both parties to run a 50-state strategy, which I think is a very helpful process.
Well, Saul, as you've illustrated here this morning, again, my friend, you are quite the scholar and student of politics in this country and in Michigan, a real treasure in that regard. I can't resist asking you to give us your thoughts on the state of the Michigan Republican Party and the National Party. I understand you are at the CPAC conference. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what's currently going on inside the Republican Party.
Yeah, look, I am optimistic about the future of the Republican Party. I mean, you know, if you take a look at the leaders that are emerging across the country, you know, we've got some 20 potential candidates for president that are in their 40s and 50s and early 60s. And truly a new generation is stepping forward. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of optimism. There's a lot of reason to be hopeful and excited about where the future of the party holds. But like in any situation, you know, we kind of go through growing pains. You know, I had a reporter ask me last week to kind of summarize the makeup of the party today. And I said, look, I think we've got pro-Trump Republicans, we have anti-Trump Republicans, and we got those who want to move on. And I think that the group that just wants to move on is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's not necessarily anti-Trump as much as it wants to bring in these next generation of leaders and take a look at where, you know, they ought to be. You know, if you go back to 2016, I think when Trump announced his candidacy, out of 168 members of the Republican National Committee, only three of them endorsed Trump. Today, probably 140 to 150 of the member, 168 members were elected under a Trump presidency, which would kind of lead you to believe that these are pretty Trumpian-like candidates who agree with whether it's the MAGA positions, the America First positions, or Trump just personally as a personality type. And we've seen many parties taken over by kind of Trump loyalists. Not completely unusual in the sense that oftentimes, you know, whether we go back to Reagan or other examples where, you know, whether conservatives or moderates went out and tried to take over the party in one way or the other, you know, but today we're in a unique situation where it's not only the MAGA Republicans, you have the ultra MAGA Republicans where you're not MAGA enough, you know, you're not Trump enough to be in the party. And, you know, look. You know, I was at CPAC. I listened to President Trump make his speech and, you know, a lot of the themes were very exciting to a lot of people. And on a policy standpoint, you know, I agree to think that most of his policies are good policies. I tend to agree with them. But I, you know, I've always expressed my concern about his style, the way he does things. I think that we need a little more temperate approach to the political process. And I'm not opposed to somebody, you know, firing up the base and getting everybody excited. But I do think there are lines that we have to be careful about crossing. And, you know, it's ironic to me, like, you know, you take a look at what happened in Michigan here and, you know, it was like you had Trump state chairs that were serving in party leadership roles and moving the party forward and working with people. And even they weren't Trump enough for a lot of the party chairs, to be a party chairman. I thought that was a very interesting scenario. And I didn't get a chance to go to this convention. So I didn't get a chance to talk to a lot of delegates and see who was there and who wasn't there. But I did talk to some of my friends who did participate, and many of them said they had no idea or had never seen many of these people ever before. You know, there's obviously questions with regards to the ability for the new chair with regards to raising money and putting together an organization and then doing what ultimately a political party is supposed to do, which is win elections and bring everyone back together. I actually just met the chairman for the first time at CPAC. She was kind of walking through the crowd and I recognized her and went up and introduced myself and wished her luck. And you know, it'll be interesting. There's a big challenge there. And, you know, this is going to be interesting. The other aspect we have to look at is, you know, what we're finding more and more in the age of super PACs and C4s and independent efforts, political parties are becoming less and less relevant in many ways. And I think on both sides of the aisle, you know, you're getting people who are getting engaged these days that are willing to write those, you know, $10 million checks, $50 million checks. The Democrats are lucky. They got a couple of folks writing $100 million checks. That's a unique situation. You know, we've changed the way, you know, we do things. You know, when I was a party chair, I mean, I would spend almost 80% of my time on the road raising money, you know, and luckily I had Jeff there working with me where on the day-to-day effort, he was there holding down the fort while, you know, was able to keep me on the road. And that's kind of how parties had evolved to. And, you know, literally the party meetings we would do would be on the side on the way to or from a donor meeting. And you have to be a good steward of the money. You have to make the case of why they ought to, you know, contribute to you. And so this is going to be the challenge. And, you know, you take a look at Ronna McDaniel, you know, getting reelected as an RNC national chairman. I mean, you know, Ronna spends over 60 to 70% of her time raising money. I mean, she has said so publicly and she's done a hell of a job for the Republicans. So, you know, I think that those people who tried to take her out, you know, maybe didn't realize A, the effort that was there, and then B, you know, an RNC race is very, you know, relationship based. I'm sure it's similar to what the DNC races are like. And so, you know, it's not only how you're winning or losing and how you did the job, although it's important that you do a decent job, if not a good job, but the relationships kind of have an overwhelming, you know, overpowering, you know, aspect of who ultimately gets elected. So, look, I think we have done this in the past on our side, you know, in 96, 80, we went through the Ford, you know, Reagan kind of change in our party, and things moved around and lots of new people got elected and everyone thought the party was going to fall apart. And we had a new renaissance and came out pretty well. 87, 88, we had the Robertson Kemp Bush scenario. I mean, very bitter battles, you know. I was in the middle of the Kemp campaign. We had the Robertson people, the Bush people. I mean, it was a very bitter, very, you know, hand-to-hand combat in Michigan and lasted for years. And then we had the Tea Party folks come in and do the Tea Party aspects of it. Now we had the MAGA, now we got the ultra MAGA. And so I think from a Republican standpoint, these are part of growing pains for us. We go through this. I suspect many of these people in another 2 to 4 years will go away. They won't like the process. They won't like going to meetings and reading minutes and hearing the reports from the treasurer and et cetera. But the power and the excitement now is, you know, we used to joke that our statutory, you know, we had a statutory requirement for a county committee to meet, and they'd be sitting in one room in the Denny's and, you know, go through 1 hour of secretary's reports, treasurer's reports, doing the things they had to do, maybe have a guest speaker. And the room right down the hall, you'd have 400, you know, fired up Tea Party people that would spend 4 hours complaining about what the county commissioner did. And they couldn't come, they couldn't wait to come back to the next meeting. Those are the challenges that that kind of an institutional party has, because by law and by structure, you know, we've got some of the boring stuff we have to do to take care of it. By law, kind of answer to the short question.
No, I'm sure some of our longtime listeners are going to be expecting some fireworks from me, but I'm not going to give too many here. I just would say that I think that the growing pains that we're going through right now, I think, are a little bit different than what we've seen historically. I wouldn't describe an anti-American cancer as a growing pain, but I agree largely with what you say about we are a center-right nation, or certainly centered to the tether, or tethered to the center, and our politics are normally played out between the 40-yard lines. And when they get out of whack, we find ourselves in this situation where we don't have a stable center right. And I think American politics requires that eventually. It's just not something that's going to be in our near future, unfortunately. We've got a lot of pains to go through as a nation in the meantime. You and I can agree to disagree on that.
No, I hear you, Jeff, but I mean, you know, part of it is also that, you know, today we elect like 90% of all of our candidates are elected in primaries. And so, you know, we don't have the same incentive that we used to have to find common ground, to reach out to the middle, to look for consensus. And I think that's the challenge, is that, you know, structurally we've gotten to the point where, you know, whether it's the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world or the AOCs of the world, they're pushing both parties to the extreme right and left. That are, and it's not always philosophical as well as much as it's political, right? You know, I always consider them, like I always say, look, I'm a, you know, they used to call me the Attila, you know, they wrote articles about me calling me the Attila the Hun of the Michigan Republican Party. And there's no question that I am philosophically extremely conservative, but I always consider myself a political moderate in the sense, you know, one of my favorite times when Mark and I used to on purpose sit down and have dinner together in public so people would see us breaking bread, having rational conversations while the next day we're beating the hell out of each other on a radio or a television interview, because that was the process. But we still wanted to do what we believed was best for Michigan, believed what was best for the country. And we could still have a rational and personal approach where, you know, over the years we've become friends, even though we vehemently disagree on very fundamental issues as to where the state and the country ought to go.
Well, Saul, my friend, and I did enjoy those dinners. I look forward to more of those. Before we let you go, handicap for us who you think is going to be the Republican nominee for president as you sit here today.
Well, I think our two strongest candidates, in my opinion, are Governor Glenn Youngkin and Governor Ron DeSantis. I think both of them bring different traits to the table. I personally, if I had a vote today, I would vote for Glenn Youngkin. I like his style better. I think his approach is better. I think he has shown how a truly hardcore conservative Republican candidate can reach out across the aisle, appeal to moderate voters, independent voters, a lot of the voters that Republicans had lost. I think those are the two strongest candidates we have. Having said that, there's no doubt that, you know, Donald Trump is a candidate to beat. He's the 800 pound gorilla in the room. The way the process is set up, his people are already working state parties to see where they can control conventions and caucuses. And so it'll be very difficult to beat him in the nominating process if he stays in. I'm also one of those people that argue there's a 50-50 chance he doesn't run for a whole lot of different reasons. And so, I think we still have to wait and see. And unfortunately, he's kind of slowing down our process of having these 20 plus, future leaders of our country on the Republican side being out there on the road, which I think would be good for the country and good for the party.
Well, Saul, thank you so much for all the work you're doing on National Popular Vote and for sharing your insights this morning on the state of American and Michigan politics. It's great to see you and talk to you again.
Yeah, it's great to be with both of you. I look forward to seeing you in Michigan. I guess you and I are going to be doing a little shtick at Central Michigan University here coming up in a couple of weeks, so that'll be fun.
Yep, looking forward to that. I still have a poster from the last time we were there. And that's a wrap for this week. Our great thanks to Saul Anuzis for joining the conversation.
If the Republic is still standing, Mark and I will return in a week. Go green. Thank you for listening.
A Republic If You Can Keep It, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Kimmer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.